found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to The Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Start your workday off right with The Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Thank you, Linda O'Brien. Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. If you're listening live, thank you so much, and download on demand. We appreciate that, too. Our program is going to be available any day now, also on iTunes, on SoundCloud. You can reach us through the MariaSanchezShow.com as well as MariaSanchezShow.com. It is Monday morning, May 13th. I hope everyone had a fabulous weekend. And for all of you mothers out there, I hope you felt celebrated and honored. I had the good fortune of having my four children with me for the day, which is so lovely because, as you know, if you've raised a family, as you get older, it's more difficult for everybody's schedules to coincide, and I feel blessed that I'm able to have that luxury in my life. I had my three sons came over on Saturday late afternoon, and I prepared a feast for us. I love to cook. I love to bake. I love to entertain, garden, do all that stuff. So I had said, how about ribs? And one of my sons says, no, we're going to do ribs for Dad's birthday, which is today, their father. And I said, okay, well, maybe then we'll do something nice and light, like a baked chicken or something. And he says, sure, great. So I get to the store, and it's like, no, bone-in ribeye roast, baked potatoes, asparagus, sautéed mushrooms with shallots and scallions and garlic. And I made a butter cake with a butter cream cheese frosting for dessert, and it was fabulous. So they spent the night, and then my daughter, who worked Saturday night, was able to drive from Santa Barbara, where she lives and works and goes to school, to join us yesterday morning, and they made a brunch. <That's> There's five of us, right? So my son said, we always have enough eggs, but if you ever want a second helping, there's usually not enough there, but you know, we have other kinds of things, so make up for it. So he decided, this is my second son Alexander, who usually commandeers these things, he bought 36 eggs, 2 pounds of bacon, 5 pounds of potatoes, cinnamon rolls, bagels, cream cheese, and we had mimosas, and it was another feast. And I did the rare thing of not working out either Saturday or Sunday, so I am feeling slothful this morning, but we'll take care of that with a big old workout. Before we get to our first guest, which is Ventura County Supervisor Kathy Long, she's going to speak with us about the ordinance requiring condoms in porn films that they enacted immediately last week. And we also have a guest on later to talk about National Memorial Day Parade, which also has a virtual aspect to it. So even if you're not in the area, you can participate. Because, of course, Memorial Day is just around the corner, and that's the official kickoff for summer. But these stories are in the news this morning. The Minnesota Senate is expected to give final approval today to a new bill that would make the state the 12th in the United States to allow same-sex couples to marry, and only the second in the Midwest. Their state house approved it last week. Governor Mark Dayton said he would sign the bill, which would make Minnesota the third state this month to legalize gay marriage after Rhode Island and Delaware. Minnesota joins Iowa as the only Midwestern state to permit gay marriage and the first to do so through legislation. Iowa has permitted same-sex marriage since 2009 under a state Supreme Court order. And as you know, the United States Supreme Court has California's Proposition 8 in front of them, and they're supposed to rule before they get out for the summer, so it should be coming within the month. And what they say about California is, so it goes in California, it blows east. So now we have 12 states that have legalized it. Prop 8 is under consideration, which disavowed same-sex marriage in the state of California. And one of the things, living in California and being raised here in California, that I love about California, in spite of some of the blue liberalism that is rampant here, which I'm fiscally conservative and socially liberal, that California was the first state in the country that legalized interracial marriage. That was 50 years ago, 5-0, Before that, it was illegal to marry somebody that was not of your same race. And obviously now that's a non-issue, a moot point. So hopefully this, the states letting the government know that this is something they want to do will also help advise the Supreme Court in that way. Then the IRS was in the news on Friday, which we spoke about briefly, because Lois Lerner, who is the director of exempt organizations, apologized for what she called inappropriate targeting of conservative groups for closer scrutiny. And there's a whole timeline thing going on because she was informed in June 2011. And then when there was an issue within Congress and they testified, they said that nothing had been done in that regard. That was then IRS commissioner was called to testify before a congressional committee. He denied that the IRS was targeting tax-exempt groups based on their politics. Well, now they've admitted it. A story that hasn't come out much is also they may have given extra special attention to the stacked tax-exempt status of some Jewish groups for political reasons. So this was in the news this morning. The pro-Israel organization Z Street has filed a lawsuit against the IRS, claiming it had been told by an IRS agent that because the organization was, quote, connected to Israel, its application for tax-exempt status would receive additional scrutiny. In addition, the IRS agent told a Z Street representative that the applications of some of those Israel-related organizations have been assigned to a, quote, special unit in the D.C. office to determine whether the organization's activities contradict the administration's public policies. And at least another Jewish organization, one that is not focused on Israel, was the recipient of bizarre and highly inappropriate questions about Israel. Those questions also came from the same nonprofit division of the IRS at issue for inappropriately targeting political conservative groups. The IRS required that that Jewish organization to state, quote, whether it supports the existence of the land of Israel, and also demanded the organization describes its religious belief system toward the land of Israel. So it's getting uglier. And then uglier still, according to a news document obtained by the ACLU, that's the American Civil Liberties Union, government officials may not always obtain warrants when they go through our emails, our Facebook messages, and other electronic communications. And the FBI apparently doesn't believe it's legally required to do so, even though in 2010, a federal appeals court ruled that declared warrantless access to email is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. The FBI has an operations guide. They revised it in June of last year. This guide makes exemptions for emails stored by a service provider for more than 180 days, meaning basically that any message that's sitting in your Gmail or Facebook folder for longer than 6 months can be looked upon without a warrant. So if your emails are downloaded to your hard drive, they're protected. They need a warrant to access those messages because they're stored on a private computer. But if emails are stored on servers like Gmail, Hotmail, Yahoo Mail, Facebook, or any third party are potentially subject to warrantless access by the government. And another snooping that's going on, so I've never thought that there's privacy with the internet or with texting or whatever. And we spoke about Snapchat on Friday, which is one of the latest things that you send a picture and it's allegedly deleted in 10 seconds. Well, on Friday there was a 24-year-old that had cracked that code for the Androids, and now he's looking to do it for the iPhones, and he's been able to successfully retrieve pictures that were sent on Snapchat. So there's that. And now the UK says that they are going to review and monitor web searches for people who have looked up symptoms related to conditions such as HIV, MRSA, MRSA, or dangerous strains of flu. They're saying that online tracking of infectious diseases could identify epidemics before patients even visit a doctor. So that means then that whatever you do is available for scrutiny, whether we like it or not. O.J. Simpson is in the news today. He's scheduled to go to a Las Vegas courtroom to get his robbery, assault, and kidnapping convictions thrown out. He has been serving more than 4 years into a 33-year prison term and is asking for a new trial. He's alleging that he got bad legal advice, which led to his arrest and conviction in a 2007 confrontation with two sports memorabilia dealers. And he was convicted of using threats, guns, and force to take back the items from the two dealers. He also says that his counsel at the time prevented him from testifying in his own defense, and the Nevada Supreme Court already upheld his conviction in 2010, but he's trying once again. His current sentence leaves him eligible for parole in 2017. Well, I had the unique experience as a journalist after O.J. was exonerated from the criminal trial and before he was convicted in the civil trial to actually interview him for 2.5 hours, because he had agreed, he had not done an interview at all with anyone at that point. He agreed to an interview with me on Los Angeles radio station KFI, which I was working with at the time, and he said, this is before syndication was very rampant, and he said that he would allow it to be broadcast on all the Cox stations, which KFI at that time was owned by. And then, because John and Ken were banging that drum so loudly, he later changed his mind. He said to me, I won't go on KFI, but I will be interviewed by you. And we had a sister station, Coast, K-O-S-T, who said, okay. And then that program director, with his inimitable wisdom, said to me, you know what, Maria, it's going to hurt us more than it's going to help because of who our listeners are. So we had a third station in that cluster, K-A-C-E, which was more urban. And O.J. said, yes, that he would allow me to interview him on that. So I went to his Brentwood home, spent 2.5 hours with him doing the pre-interview. That was the first time that we met face-to-face. And after that, he said, great, let me know whatever time, whatever publicity. You can have print and television cameras in the studio, and I will tell my story. So I go back to the boss, and I say, we got it, and we've got this, we've got that. And the big boss says, you know what, that station is run by a program director. I'm not going to tell him how to run his station. I believe in delegating authority. So the program director, in his stupidity, said to me, great, Maria, thanks for getting OJ for us for an interview. I'm going to assign it to another member of our staff. And I was like, no, I'm the one that got it. At that time, we've got more stories to cover too, but because this coincidentally has a small Barbara Walters angle. Barbara Walters had said the three people that she would like to have interviewed and never did was Mother Teresa, Princess Diana, and O.J. Simpson. And I had scored this interview. It was going to be a worldwide exclusive. So the program director of KACE said to me, and I said, well, he agreed to do it with me. And he says to me, frankly, Maria, you can't speak to the needs of our community. I said, I see. Reverse racism. So like the good colleague that I was, I went back to OJ and I said that KACE will air the interview, but they won't let me do it. And OJ said, if you're not doing it, I'm not doing it. I'm only doing it if you are the person who's going to be asking me the questions. And so my pre-interview of 2.5 hours, which was not recorded because it was the pre-interview, is just there for the memory, and the real one that was supposed to occur never did. So that's O.J. Simpson in the news. So now we are going to call Kathy Long, Supervisor Kathy Long's office, to get her take on what they did last week with the enacting the condom ordinance.
Supervisor Long's office.
Good morning, Supervisor Long. This is Maria Sanchez, and you're on the Maria Sanchez Show this morning. Hello.
Hi, Maria. Good to talk to you.
And great to speak with you, as always. Kathy is a supervisor with the County of Ventura 3rd District, and thank you for agreeing to speak with us about the ordinance that you voted upon last week. Do you want to give our listeners a background on the story and why you felt that something was needed to be enacted?
I sure would. Thank you. The background is that in Newberry Park, in that area of our county, and the unincorporated area, we were seeing an increased request for filming permits from the industry, in the industry for adult films. And so seeing that request, also hearing from neighbors that they were having filming right next door that was very disruptive to the community, and some personal countings that were pretty horrifying to our community. And so Supervisor Parks came and talked with me. I'd started to see some interest in the same area, in the unincorporated area of Camarillo. So we took a look at the ordinance that was enacted both in Simi and in Los Angeles County and decided to move ahead to do the same for our county.
Now, film permits, that's just required because of the impact that it has on the community, regardless of if it's adult in nature?
That's correct. We have, in fact, we have a strong filming interest in our county for decades. And so we've had ordinances on the book that govern permits for filming related to hours they can film, areas they can film that are have to address the community concerns for traffic impact, noise impact, lighting impact. So we've had that in place for decades. And this particular interest in filming from the adult film industry, of course, came as a result of being an ordinance passed in L.A., actually a ballot initiative passed in L.A., and putting additional requirements for the public health on adult filming.
So if our listeners aren't familiar with what happened with the County of Los Angeles, that was a ballot initiative in November that was asking the performers in the adult film industry to wear condoms while they're filming or engaged in the acts of coitus or whatever. So when that happened, then that meant that these industries wanted to go to another area where they wouldn't have to do that, enact.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So since we border Los Angeles County in Ventura County, was it dramatic, the increase in the number of permits requested?
No, it wasn't, but it was enough that it got our attention, in addition to the neighbors calling specifically Supervisor Park's office, because that's where it first started to, after CME passed their ordinance, and then they started to see more interest in and permit being pulled in the Newbury Park area.
And now, do you want to describe the rationale in terms of the health, what it is that you're looking to do? Because I know public health is involved in this as well, correct?
Yes, public health under our ordinance, and I believe others, is the point person, in the sense of if someone comes in from the industry to get a permit to film, they get their standard filming permit and have to abide by all those guidelines in the film permit. Then they have to get a second permit from the public health department. And in that permit, it will they have to check off the boxes that say that their performers will be wearing protection to protect protect them, and then, you know, to address our public health concerns. And then the public health director issues that permit, or his designee. And then they have to post where the filming takes place, where it's visible to the public, that they have acquired those permits. And if there's a complaint from someone in the area or whatever, a complaint is called in, then the sheriff's office replies to that complaint to verify that the permits have been acquired and that they're abiding by the permit.
Now, who enforces whether or not they actually follow through with the practice of the condoms?
The law enforcement, just as they would with any ordinance and permit that's issued in the county for filming. Law enforcement replies to complaints that let's say, for instance, in a community where they're supposed to be shut filming down by 10 o'clock at night and they're still filming at midnight. Folks call the police and the police respond. Same here.
So, but are the film crews asked to self-police their behaviors during the production, or is there somebody supposed to be on set that monitors it?
Well, they are supposed to self-police, and that's the issue with the industry, is that they haven't been self-policing. You know, in the ballot initiative that LA passed, there were plenty of real-life stories of infected actors who would then, you know, one particular actor who infected 189 people with AIDS. You know, that's a health impact. And that is what the interest is here. So they haven't been self-policing, let me say that.
So since that's been proven to be true, are there any teeth in the Ventura County initiative that's going to help make sure that they do what they say they're going to do?
Well, it's a deterrent, let me say that. And if we have an instance where someone pulls a permit and they're in a neighborhood and becomes a disturbance to the surrounding neighbors, the neighbors call, the police will respond. They have every authority to go on the property, inspect to see if they have the permits and if they're complying with the permit, which means all of the protective measures that are written in the ordinance.
And
so
we'll
see.
Because I was going to say, obviously, if authorities are responding, I would imagine that the performers would not engage in the behavior and put on clothing. And, you know, I mean, it's going to be tough to enforce, I would imagine.
Well, they have to show evidence on the set that they provide the protective materials mm-hmm. and that the actors are all informed of what their rights and the laws are. And, you know, so that's kind of the first enforcement steps that are taken. Now, you don't have officers standing around watching the performance take place to see if they're wearing protective gear. That's not the intent, nor will it frankly be the practice. But they have to show evidence. And if let's say an officer goes and one of the performers says, I didn't know I had to do this or had this right, then that's a violation.
Okay. Do you want to speak specifically about how sexually transmitted diseases and HIV and AIDS have affected the county of Ventura? Because the numbers are kind of alarming. I didn't realize.
Well, they are. And I unfortunately, I think the general public thinks that we have AIDS under control as a nation, frankly, and that the disease is, you know, de minimis, and it's not. Like in our recent report from, and we have a standing AIDS advisory committee in this county, and the public health officer is on that committee, and they oversee programs and services that are provided to the community to help to inform them and protect them. And there were 26 reported cases of HIV in 2011, and last year they went up to 46. Mm. So that's almost double.
Mm-hmm.
And the AIDS death in the same period increased from 14 to 21. Now, back in the day, in the early days of this horrendous disease, you were seeing upwards of 100. I mean, it really was horrifying. And, of course, over the years, the medical advancement has been able to provide treatment that has helped to lower those infection and death rates. But we still have them. And in the industry itself, and according to American Public Health Association data for a four-year period of time, 18% to 26% of performers were diagnosed with at least one infection of STD or AIDS and HIV. So when you get upwards of 26% of performers, that has a multiplying effect that's mm-hmm. pretty horrifying. Mm-hmm.
Well, and we did a story last week that there's a super sex bug that has been discovered, and it was in Asia with a sex worker. It's in four places in the world. California is one of those four places.
Yes, I know. I saw that, and that is horrifying.
Now, and some people, Supervisor Long, might not realize how prolific the adult film industry is. Can you speak to those numbers of productions that we're not just talking about a couple hundred episodes or incidents?
Oh, no. It's the biggest film industry in the world. 11,000 films each year the industry produces. 4 to 11,000, and I believe it's probably upwards of that. And then L.A. Employs an estimated 2,000 to 3,000 performers.
So,
and unfortunately, those performers are often young people who, you know, either aren't aware of their rights or a variety of reasons that they're in the industry.
Right, and that they might not get exploited or taken advantage
right.
of because they would rather conform than not. But that's like 900 films a month. I mean, that's
yeah.
staggering if you do the math on that.
Yeah, I know.
Which it's a lot. So what brought this up specifically? That there were complaints in Newbury Park, and that was Supervisor Park's district, and then you wanted, as the Board of Supervisors, to do something that was going to mm-hmm. unify and perhaps discourage productions in the County of Ventura?
Correct. And again, we only have authority in the unincorporated area, not in the city. So each city would have to do the same if they feel they should or are having issues. in the unincorporated area. Now we have this ordinance, and frankly, I think that's where the filming industry would look first, because they're typically going to go to more of the larger homes and somewhat isolated areas. And frankly, they go up in Newbury Park. They were going door to door with flyers, offering significant money to be able to rent your home for a couple of days to do filming. So,
And then in terms, CME did it. So, are they the only city in the county that's done it too? Put in an ordinance?
Yes, Camarillo has done a moratorium, and they have extended that moratorium just last week to another, I want to say, 8 months. And so they've just basically shut all filming down.
So you couldn't even get a permit in the city of Camarillo.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, did anybody speak before, for or against this, or is this just an agenda item?
No, there were some neighbors who did speak in favor of it, but that was it. A couple neighbors, and I received probably 5 letters and some emails.
And if anybody wants more information or a call to action, what should they do?
Well, they could certainly contact my office or Supervisor Park's office or go online to the county's website to at least review what the ordinance calls for, so they're aware of it. And in that, it will say that if they have a complaint, they should issue that complaint with the county, and we would send inspectors out, public health or law enforcement as needed. And again, if it's in their neighborhood and they feel they have an immediacy, they can always call law enforcement, and law enforcement will follow through.
Well, thank you for your time, and thank you for your continued service to the county. Do you want to give a little background in case folks don't know who you are with your career?
Well, I am a county supervisor, and I've been a pleasure to serve the public for the last 16 years. I represent the cities of Camarillo, Port Hueneme, South Oxnard, Santa Paula, Fillmore, and unincorporated areas in between. And Camarillo's my home.
Thank you. And thank you for your service. We appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Maria. Always good to talk to you.
Take care. So that is Supervisor Kathy Long weighing in on the condom ordinance, which they just voted on. They meet every Tuesday morning, so tomorrow it will be a week. And we tried to get somebody on last week, but they were so busy. So I was happy that Kathy Long was able to take advantage of our time this morning. A few stories that are still breaking is that apparently Barbara Walters will be calling it quits today. They're expecting the announcement on her show, The View. She started in 1961 at NBC's Today, where she became a co-host, and in 1976 she made history by becoming the first female to anchor an evening news program when she joined ABC Evening News, and then she became a co-host of 2020 3 years later. She created The View in 1997, and she's going to retain her title of executive producer of the show even after she ceases to appear on it. She is a role model, 83 years of age. I admire her career tremendously and really think at 83, that's how old my father is. He's been retired for like 15 years. And so that's, look at her, to keep on working. So, we try to focus as much as we can on the positive. In fact, I was talking with my sons over the weekend about the woman who had the 5th successful face transplant procedure. And they're like, Mom, we don't want to hear about it. It's disgusting about this, because about how it happened with her soon-to-be ex-husband poured industrial-grade lye on her face, which obliterated her face. And so I appreciate that, but I also think that it's important that we know what's going on in the world so that, you can be conversant about it and or you can try and find out more information if you want. So Ariel Castro, the disgusting example of the worst, heinous kind of human being on the planet, his two brothers did an exclusive interview with CNN's Martin Savage over the weekend. And, of course, they're trying to distance themselves as much as possible from him because they haven't been accused of anything, even though they were both taken, all three of them were taken to court a week ago today, actually. And the two brothers were discharged. They had minor things that each was $100 to get rid of it. But they said they have received death threats since their arrest. There's rocks been thrown through their house. They're in hiding, if you would. And they're saying that their lives are forever changed. But the one thing that's interesting about it is, of course, not of course, but they're calling him a monster who should rot in jail. And they don't think that he should get the death penalty because they said he should just suffer for as long as possible. So what they said, which was common with what the other stories have been said, is that they didn't go to the house very much. And when they did, they wouldn't let Ariel wouldn't let them pass the kitchen. Curtains blocked the kitchen from the rest of the 1,400 square foot house. And Ariel said it was an energy saving setup. They also said the radio was playing all the time, and if not the radio, the TV. Something had to be on all the time in the kitchen. So I couldn't hear anything else but the radio or the TV. The child, who it has been confirmed that Ariel fathered with Amanda Berry, was allowed to venture outside of the house at times, and Ariel would take her with him. They saw him with her at McDonald's. They saw him with her at Burger King and in the park. And when asked, who is she? He would respond that she's a daughter of my girlfriend. So one of the other things that has come out, which is horrific, is that Gina De Jesus' father, Felix, was friendly with the brothers. And now they're saying, how could Ariel, have interacted with the family of one of the hostages? They all knew Felix De Jesus, the daughter of Gina, which was the 14-year-old who was kidnapped on her way home from school 9 years ago. One of the brothers, O'Neill, said, I would ask him, Felix, no sign of her yet? No sign of her yet? Not knowing that this monster had these young women in his house. I would shake his hand and tell him, man, I'm sorry. Have you heard anything? Let's just hang in there, brother. That's what Pedro said. Ariel even attended a vigil for the teen after she went missing and gave her mama a hug. This is according to the brothers' interviews. So one of the other quotes, I hope he rots in that jail. I don't even want them to take his life like that. I want him to suffer in that jail to the last extent. I don't care if they even feed him. What has he done? What he has done to my life and my family's? Well, how about for the three gals? So they're hiding in an undisclosed location, and they've received death threats online. Another tragic story in the news out of the Valley Springs. People in the town, which is 60 miles southeast of Sacramento, were relieved that there hadn't been an arrest in the stabbing death of an 8-year-old girl, Layla Fowler. But the authorities have arrested her 12-year-old brother, the one who discovered her and called his parents and then called 911. So today, Calaveras Unified School District, the superintendent says that counselors will be available today at all the schools. And police said there was no sign of a burglary or robbery, and they spent more than 2,000 hours on the investigation before they arrested the boy over the weekend on Saturday. Of course, they're not releasing his name because he's a minor. Of course, it's easy to find, but we won't share that because that's not how we do things here. Okay, distracted driving was in the news all week last week, and it's today is no exception. In a national survey, but here's something interesting about the process. Half of all respondents 16 years or older admitted to having texted while driving behind the wheel. So we talked about this. We had a guest on last week about distracted driving. There was a couple of surveys that were out that talked about you're 23 times more likely to get in an accident while you're texting and driving. It's also now the leading killer of teens taking over from driving under the influence for deaths. So what they're saying today, though, is with this study, that the teens who admitted to texting while driving are more likely to engage in other risky behavior, such as irregular seatbelt use and drinking while driving. So this was released today by the journal Pediatrics. So they're saying this risky behavior is something that isn't just isolated. And teens who text and drive are 5 times more likely to also drink and drive. So the cool thing about this survey, though, is they're saying that the parents are going to be the most effective in preventing this kind of behavior. So it's giving it back to the family, and it's not. So I'm just saying, heads up if you suspect that. Now, my youngest is 21, and I know that she texts and drives. And so all of these stories having come out in the last 10 days, I've been forwarding them to her, and in the subject I say, please don't text and drive. So this morning was no exception. I sent this to her. The issue of distracted driving has been coming up. So the National Safety Council also concluded recently that crash deaths by drivers on the phone were seriously underreported nationwide, which we spoke about last week, which makes it compounds the problem because it makes it seem less serious. And we quoted some of the statistics, like Tennessee had more reports of fatalities on the phone than the state of California. And you know that can't be the case just based on our population. So Dr. Andrew Adsman, who co-authored the study for the Centers for Disease Control recently, said it's imperative that the problem be addressed at all levels due to the danger. Texting while driving is just becoming sort of epidemic, and it's a higher cause of death than even drinking while driving. The impairment that comes with texting is worse than drinking while driving. So that's for all of us. Bill Gates did an interview with CBS's 60 Minutes and Charlie Rose, and he got emotional. And it's something that you might, if you didn't get a chance to watch, you might want to look, because he grew emotional as he recalled visiting Jobs just before his death. He welled up as he described their last conversation, which he said was forward-looking. He showed me the boat he was working on and talked about how he's looking forward to being on it, even though we both knew there was a good chance that wouldn't happen. He and I, in a sense, grew up together. We were within a year of the same age, and we were kind of naively optimistic and built big companies. And every fantasy we had about creating products and learning new things, we achieved all of it, and most of it as rivals. But we always retained a certain respect and communication, including even when he was sick. And so he tells a couple of cute stories about him, even uses a profanity, because that's what Jobs was. They were supposed to go out to dinner, and Jobs had his, I think he called Bill Gates a secretary, is what Bill Gates said. And he said, I'm not going to go to dinner, and if he needs an answer, tell him that I'm an asshole. So that's what he said, which Bill Gates, and he said, would that be the case? And he says, yes, that would be the case, but I believe it was because he was, you know, unwell. So it wasn't just like he was saying F you. So if you haven't read the biography on Steve Jobs, I highly recommend it. I read it a year ago when it came out. It's really, really revealing. And I've never been an Apple person. I've always done the traditional PC thing until I broke down and went to the dark side and got my iPhone 5 a couple of months ago, which I'm still jousting with. But one of the things that I was struck with is his ambition, his determination, his exacting nature, his demand for excellence from everybody at all times of the day and night. And I would imagine he was a difficult man to live with, just reading between the lines. He gave the author unfettered access to everyone in his life and did not ask for any editorial control, which is fairly remarkable. I do believe that the author skimmed over the relationships with his wife and three children, because he didn't really go into that, and obviously that's a significant part of his life. The other thing that I noticed that was interesting is that there was very little mention of philanthropy in his life, and that was one thing that there was an interview that I watched where the two of them were together at it was a two-on-two interview, and Steve Jobs said about Bill Gates that this world is a better place because of the philanthropy that Bill Gates is engaged in with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which they are changing the face of the world in terms of health and wellness. And I have a personal insight into that, in that I'm a proud member of Rotary, and Rotary is one of the mottos for Rotary is service above self. And Rotary has been endeavoring since 1985 to eradicate polio on the face of the earth. So when Rotary first got involved in the campaign, there were over 350,000 cases of polio per year. There are less than 1,000 now. It will only be the second time in the history of the planet that a disease will be eradicated from the face of the earth, second to smallpox. And it's Rotarians, boots on the ground, along with the World Health Organization, the Center for Disease Control, and the Bill and Melinda Gates, most recently making it possible. Because the polio vaccine, it's endemic now in three countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria. It used to be in India until last year. India had zero incidences. You have to have zero incidences for 3 years in order to be declared polio free. So the three remaining countries, the problem and why it's still existent there is because of their political situations. So Rotary tries to negotiate for a ceasefire and wave the white flag, and then we run in, we immunize. It's a drops that we put, and you have to do it. You have to catch the children from 0 to 5. Because of their dysentery and their intestinal tract issues, oftentimes it has to be administered 5 times before it actually finally sticks or stays in their system. We don't often have the time and the luxury to do that because we have to get out because they have to get back with their fighting. So I was honored enough to be able to go to India just over 2 years ago with Rotary and to participate in National Immunization Days and to firsthand actually administer the drops and to tour the sites. And I flew into New Delhi, and there were about 30 of us that came from the Western United States, mostly from California. And we got the lay of the land, and we were taken to different things. We even went to the factory where they make the drops to immunize against polio. And then we were sent to various areas. And I had the dubious distinction of being sent to Bareilly, which was ground zero for polio in India, and had the opportunity to go in the slums and to administer the vaccine and to try to help. Some of the families were resistant because they had been told falsehoods about what the polio vaccine was going to do to the virility of their sons. And most of that is not an issue anymore. But to give you an idea of how impacted India is, going from Delhi to Bareilly is about maybe 120 miles, I think. It took us 8 hours to get there. We had a driver, and there were 6 of us in the car, and that's because of the mopeds and the motorcycles and the camels and the monkeys and the cows and the cars and the bicycles. It was something else. So thank you to Bill and Melinda Gates. They partnered with Rotary. They said, you guys are the boots on the ground. You're already making it work. We're going to give you money. It was a matching grant. We matched it, so we're well on our way. So keep that in mind. Now we are calling the Tim Holbert, who's the executive director of the American Veterans Center, and we're going to speak with him about the National Memorial Day Parade.
Well, this is Tim.
Hi, Tim. Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez. You're on the Maria Sanchez Show. How are you?
Morning. Good.
Good, Tim. I just introduced you to our listeners as the executive director of the American Veterans Center and the program director of World War II Veterans Committee.
That's right.
And you've got a big event coming up, and we wanted to help get the word out about it because you also have a virtual way to participate as well.
That's absolutely right.
So let's talk first about the parade, where it is, because I know it's well attended and you get great coverage and we can watch it, at least, if we can't be there.
That's right. Well, it's the National Memorial Day Parade coming up 2 weeks from today, actually. Here in Washington, D.C., it's along Constitution Avenue. We pass right by the White House, the National Archives, the Washington Monument. So it's a really great event. Been going on about 9 years. This is the 9th year for it. And it's a huge event, as you said. A couple 100,000 spectators come out, national televised audience, and we also stream it online as well.
And what is the purpose other than, obviously, patriotism?
Sure. Well, you know, we started the parade 9 years ago. We had been seeing a lot of news around that time of Memorial Day parades across the country, really kind of fading away almost as the World War II generation that really organized them and drove them was you know, obviously passing from the scene. You know, these news stories were really almost everywhere at the time, and you know, this is a tradition that goes back till just after the Civil War of parades on Memorial Day. So we decided to step up and create one big one for the country to really help call attention to the real meaning of the day. We were actually shocked to find that Washington hadn't had a regular parade in almost 70 years. So we stepped in to fill that void. Just to get families to come out for a family-friendly event that calls attention to the meaning, to where it's more than just barbecues and swimming pools and things along those lines, but focusing on the purpose of the day.
So who participates in the parade itself?
Well, the parade is, as you could say, a moving timeline of American military history. So
Oh.
We have tributes throughout from the very beginning, from the Native Americans and the American Revolution. We have actually George Washington from Mount Vernon that comes out every year, and reenactors from Continental soldiers all the way through the Civil War till you get to World War I. World War II, we actually have veterans that participate all the way up to the present day. where the grand finale are hundreds and hundreds of active duty service members. You know, everybody participating to help honor, you know, those who made the ultimate sacrifice. And then we have great support from marching bands throughout, and a number of celebrity participants as well.
Can you name any that we should?
Sure. Absolutely. Have a great lineup this year. Grand Marshal this year is J.R. Martinez, Army Wounded Warrior, who many remember from winning Dancing with the Stars a couple of years ago. He'll be joining us. Country music star Trace Adkins has a new album out tomorrow. He'll be joining us as honorary Grand Marshal. Also with us will be Robert Griffin III, Washington Redskins quarterback, along with his parents. They're both U.S. Army vets, and to help call attention to Army families. Taylor Hicks, winner of American Idol, Miss America 2013, will be joining us, as well as actors Gary Sinise and Joe Mantegna. So
nice.
Just a huge, huge lineup, and it'll really be great.
That's nice. I'm glad to see that. And what a nice cross-section of folks that are helping out get the word out.
Well, and that's really what makes it great is, you know, you have Americans of all backgrounds, all interests, and really the support is fantastic from the world of entertainment, from the world of sports. And it's really about people doing, you know, their small part to say, you know, on a day like Memorial Day that they, you know, really appreciate the sacrifices that our military's made.
And, Tim, what time does it start?
The parade's at 2 p.m. Eastern. Okay. It runs for 2 hours from 2 to 4. You know, like I said, right along Constitution Avenue.
And what, describe the virtual aspect of the Boots on the Ground, please.
Sure. At the website's www.virtualbootsontheground.com. That allows people, it's just a fun way for them to participate from home. So they can go and register, and they can create their own avatar that will virtually march along the parade route. At the same time, we also have the parade's television stream that streams from the website, so they can watch the broadcast from there and then participate virtually. So it's just a way to you know, engage people that if you're not able to come out to Washington that day, it's another fun way to take part from your own hometown.
Tim, I don't think I've ever heard of a parade having historical theme to it. I like this, that you start from the beginning and right up to modern day. And do you have commentators that will share what it is that folks are looking at?
We do. You know, the television broadcast, it's just like you're watching a version of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
Mm-hmm.
They'll tell you everything about what we're watching, you know, also giving historical significance to everything in there. Again, we want to make it a fun broadcast. We want everybody who comes out to have a great time. But really, the big purpose is to, you know, educate and honor, you know, again, those who made the ultimate sacrifice. So that's a theme that runs throughout the entire broadcast.
So I would imagine this is not easy to pull together, even after 9 years.
It's not. It is a tremendous amount of work, and more work every year as it grows, but it's a lot of fun.
And can folks help out in terms of donations, or do you have newsletters? Or?
Absolutely. They can donate at NationalMemorialDayParade.com. Just go to the website, and that's really important, too. You know, we are the American Veterans Center is a 501c3 nonprofit. We started this from scratch, like I said, 9 years ago. We're not taking federal money. This is not a government program. This was just, you know, private citizens that said, hey, you know, on Memorial Day of any day, we need to make sure that, you know, that our military and again, those who made the ultimate sacrifice are really, really honored. So contributions are absolutely welcome and needed.
Now, if somebody's listening and would like to participate next year, do they submit something, a request to be allowed to be in it, or how does that work?
That's right. All that information, applications, and so on are found at NationalMemorialDayParade.com, and they can grab one of those there and submit it, you know, we just go from there.
And can you tell us about the shrinking World War II veteran population? Where are we now?
There's, you know, nobody knows exactly how many. It's probably somewhere around 1.5 million left out of 16 million originally. You know, the numbers that pass away per day, you'll see numbers of anywhere from about 800 to 1,500 pass away per day. So, honoring them is, you know, we're obviously running out of time to have the veterans themselves out. And time is of the essence when honoring our greatest generation. we actually had in the parade the last living veteran of World War One a few years ago, Frank Buckles.
My goodness.
Who just died 2 years ago. And that was the end of an era. And you know, unfortunately, we'll be approaching that day with the World War II generation soon. So yes, you know, time really is of the essence there.
Tim, thank you for your time. I'm excited to be able to help promote this, and it sounds like a fascinating, wonderful event.
It really is, and I really appreciate your help.
You're welcome. We'll post all of that contact information when we post our show for download. And again, that's Tim Holbert, Executive Director of the American Veterans Center, and we'll put that onto the website at the MariaSanchezShow.com, MariaSanchezShow.com, LATalkRadio.com. Our time's up. Looking forward to visiting with you tomorrow. Thank you so much for your ears. This is Maria Sanchez. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.